Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We spend a lot of time on this program, but precious few others seem to do. The same level of careful analysis and commentary about one of the most, if not the single most important aspect of the war for the free world, and that is preventing the use of thermonuclear weapons against our country and others in our Western civilization. There are large numbers of such weapons, of course, in the world. A great many of them, unfortunately, are in the hands of very dangerous regimes, some of which have made it very clear that their purpose is our destruction. Others are aspiring to get their hands on them, may have, may shortly. A man who has devoted his entire professional life, I believe that's over 40 years of highly distinguished public service, and now in the private sector, to the basics, the fundamentals of nuclear deterrence, what it takes, what we're up against, how not to try to assure our survival in the face of the various threats we face, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. We spoke with him briefly last week, and there was so much more to discuss that we asked him to come back promptly, and he has graciously agreed to do so. His name is Dr. Mark Schneider. I had the privilege of working with him a lifetime ago in the Department of Defense. At the time, he had already rendered some important public service as a foreign service officer working in the Department of State. He had also been in various capacities in the Defense Department. He was working for me at the time as the director of our Strategic Forces and Arms Control shop. And he went on to serve a number of others in the role that I played and in other important functions as really the duty expert in the Defense Department when it came to matters involving strategic forces policy and what, if anything, we could usefully do with respect to arms control, especially in the light of something that Mark Schneider studied more carefully, wrote more lucidly about, and argued, I think, more effectively concerning, namely, than anybody else in the government that I know of, namely, the lack of compliance with arms control agreements, literally, all of them, by the Soviet Union, now by the Russians, and to the extent they've been in them, the Chinese and other of these malefactors that we're seeking to deter. I find it extraordinarily bracing to talk with Mark, and I hope you do as well. I always learn something. I always find that there are more things that we need to know about, especially the vast majority of us who are simply not paying attention to these somewhat arcane and often very, very troubling issues. But that's why we have him back. And Mark, I'm so glad that you found time to join us once again for a deeper dive into the challenges that you've spent your life trying to address now as a senior fellow at the National Institute for Public Policy, where you write, again, so effectively on all of these issues. Thank you once again for joining us, sir. Welcome back. Let's start, Mark, with sort of the most basic proposition. Why is nuclear deterrence important in a world like this, where we're often told we're the world's sole superpower? And surely everybody else knows that, and they're not going to fool with us, are they?
Well, unfortunately, there's been an enormous decline in the relative American military power. Since the end of the Cold War, about 30 years ago, we've seen a massive increase in Chinese military and nuclear weapons expenditures, typically 8 to 10% a year, and over 20 years, over 10%. That's just totally unprecedented. And it's in the context of the only serious threat to China in the early 90s, the Soviet Union going away. So this is aimed at fighting the United States. Since about 2010, we've seen the same sort of increases in Russia. And the two are increasingly working together. It's not a real alliance in the sense that there's any real commitment to each other, but they're exploiting each other to hurt the United States.
An aspiration that they share. I think this is really important to make clear, Mark Schneider.
I don't think either one would fight the United States for the other one, but they could very well exploit a war started by the other one to engage in a military adventure in their part of the world. Now, the most significant reason we've got to deter nuclear weapons is because if we don't, these weapons could be used against us, and in a worst case, a substantial portion of the American people would die as a result of that. And that has to be prevented at all costs. Now, the American left simultaneously is trying to argue that nuclear weapons are useless because no one would use them. And, by the way, they have to be banned because they're so destructive. And, by the way, they can deter the use of nuclear weapons with conventional forces. Now, those two views are totally inconsistent. The idea that you can deter something as destructive as nuclear weapons with conventional forces is absolutely ridiculous. And if we try to do that, there will be a nuclear war.
But speak to that first point, Mark Schneider, and we'll drill down, as I say, more on all of this in a moment. But is it the case that everybody understands that nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought?
Well, that's said all the time. But the unfortunate reality is that neither the Russian or Chinese leadership actually believe that. They are procuring warfighting capabilities on a large scale. They're exploiting the degradation of the U.S. nuclear deterrent, which is largely the product of left-wing thinking in the United States. And while you will hear Putin sometimes say that, more often he is making overt nuclear threats, first-use threats, against the United States and our allies, NATO. And that is something that has to be deterred.
Right. Has to be first recognized and then acted upon in a manner that does indeed successfully maintain deterrence against any such tendency. Mark, we have to pause for a moment. When we come back, I want to drill down on Putin. I keep using that phrase, but it does seem as though when you're talking about things like missile silos, drill down does seem to be an appropriate metaphor. But we are going to discuss what Vladimir Putin specifically and personally seems to be thinking about and doing about degrading our nuclear deterrent and perhaps creating conditions under which he can have his way in the world. That and much more with Dr. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy, one of the most brilliant and competent practitioners of the business of nuclear deterrence and national security, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Mark Schneider, a longtime friend and colleague, a man I've come to admire greatly over the years, who has devoted literally his entire professional life, both in the United States government and now at the National Institute for Public Policy, to helping ensure that we deter aggression against this country, particularly of the nuclear kind. And Mark, you set up beautifully this segment because I want to talk about Vladimir Putin, what we think he thinks about nuclear weaponry and its utility, as evidenced by not just his rhetoric, which, as you said, Mark, can be a bit of this and a bit of that, but by his behavior. In particular, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the role he plays in nuclear exercises with great regularity, and whether that's a pretty extraordinary thing when you think about it.
Well, there's a linkage here to Russian nuclear doctrine, which Putin is unique in history. He's the only president of Russia or the United States or any other country that I'm aware of that developed his own nuclear weapons doctrine, which involved the first use of nuclear weapons quite early in a war. And he exercises that capability all the time. He presides over the large strategic nuclear exercises that Russia holds. I mean, we had a unique example of this in October of last year, where literally half of the entire Russian strategic nuclear force was involved in it. And according to one of their most important journalists, it ended with a massive launch.
Now, simulated launch, to be sure, but it did involve the launch of a significant number of ballistic missiles, both land-based and sea-based, did it not?
The Russians announced the exact order of battle for the exercise, which involved hundreds of their strategic nuclear missiles and bombers. That's unique.
And some number of those were actually launched, not just simulated.
The live launches involved four ICBMs and SLBMs, as well as probably about a dozen nuclear cruise missile types were launched from their bombers and from other launchers, sea-based and land-based.
So they demonstrated this is not just a paper tabletop exercise, as they say. This was a real drill.
Yeah. Putin presided over it, gave a launch order, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, and they simulated several hundred missile launches, nuclear missile launches. There's no ambiguity about that because these missiles don't have conventional capability.
And what was the simulated target of this immense laydown of destructive nuclear weaponry?
Obviously, the United States and NATO, particularly for the non-strategic weapons that they launched and simulated the launch of.
So those are the tactical nuclear weapons. And Mark, one of the things that you've done yeoman work on for many years is pointing out, when we're talking about nuclear deterrence, that that is a class of weaponry for which we basically have negligible counterpart capability, right?
Yeah. Yes. We have one remaining non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapon, the B-61 bomb. As of now, there is no active program to develop anything else. There is the Nuclear Posture Review said we will go ahead with a naval sub and surface ship, presumably launched cruise missile, nuclear cruise missile. That's not yet reached the level of anybody really doing research on it. We're still doing with studies of alternative possibilities.
So compared, we're going to talk more about what we're doing and what we have in place and what we need to in our last block, Mark. But just for the moment, let's stay with Russia. What, in addition to maintaining immense numbers of these tactical nuclear weapons and improving their capabilities, give us just a sense, and you've done this before on the show, and it's always stunning to me, but just update us, Mark, as best you can, on what you call the order of battle, what the Russians have now put into place in terms of modern strategic nuclear arsenal components across what we think of as the full spectrum of the nuclear triad.
Well, Putin has, within the last couple of months, has just stated that they have modernized 82% of their strategic nuclear forces. Now, just a few days ago, the commander of STRATCOM, Admiral Richards, stated that they had modernized 76% of their strategic nuclear forces. So the difference is trivial. And by the way, the comparable U.S. number today is zero, and we'll hit 76% sometime, if we're really lucky, somewhere between 15 and 20 years from now.
Wow. So again, we're gonna drill down on that further, but just with the Russians, is there a stone left unturned? Let me put it that way, in terms of the comprehensiveness of the buildup that the Russians have engaged in. You've mentioned land-based missile systems, ballistic missile systems specifically, sea-launched ones, air-breathing, as they're called, bombers and cruise missiles. Mark Schneider, what's the scope of this effort? Can you calibrate it for us?
Well, according to Admiral Richards, it's, quote, aggressive and robust. We have 20-plus announced Russian programs for new or modernized strategic nuclear delivery systems, and almost all of them are actually new. Admiral Richards said it's easier to list the systems they haven't modernized than the ones they have. Well, that's certainly true, because I can think of only one that they have today that they haven't been modernized, and that's going to be gone in a few years. So they're modernizing everything. They've officially announced that they will have complete modernization of their strategic nuclear forces within 4 years. That, I think, may be slightly optimistic, but they'll certainly be well into the 90s by then. But the worst part of this is two things. One, they're not only modernizing, they're expanding. They've just announced a program to deploy 20 regiments of Sarmat heavy ICBMs. That's 2 to 3 times the number that was previously reported in Russia. And this thing literally has 10 times the throw weight and potentially 20 times the number of warheads as a U.S. ICBM. So this is going to be going on for a long time over the next decade. And it's going to the other aspect of their modernization is literally never ending. They finish a program, they're already underway on its follow-on, whether it's an improved version of that system or a brand-new system. It's never any different. And Putin actually said this in December of last year. He said, we can't rest on our laurels. We've modernized, I think he said something like 70% of their overall military capability. But, you know, we're going to complete this, and then we're going to modernize again.
Mark, so let me ask you about this. One of the things that, you know, is sometimes said to kind of, well, explain away this extraordinary level of effort and expenditure on the part of a country that, let's face it, doesn't have a whole lot of resources, is that, well, that's really the only thing that makes them a major power in the world, a superpower for that matter. And yet, when you connect the dots here, as you have so well and so consistently over the years, between that level of effort, which is by any measure unbelievably huge, with the doctrine, with the personal investment of Putin in, you know, the war fighting strategies, it does raise the question, are we missing, fundamentally missing, this really portentous effort that I think has in its sort of DNA, if you will, the purpose of being a dominant power, not simply one of the players at the world stage. Your thoughts?
Well, they certainly want that. They want domination initially over Eastern Europe, the former Warsaw Pact states. They want what's been, you know, historically the old Soviet Union and the former Warsaw Pact satellite states. They certainly want what's called historically a sphere of influence. They want to be able to dictate the policies of these states, their bordering states, they want subservience. The real risky thing from a nuclear war standpoint is they're in a position now, and this will continue, where they can seize bordering NATO states very quickly, because we don't have any serious deployments in Eastern Europe. yet. And we, under the current program, it's a mobilization. It's called the 30-30-30, where we, within 30 days, we mobilize 30 battalions and 30 warships and 30 aircraft squadrons. Well,
and the troops have to be largely gotten from here over there, right? So that's a whole nother problem, of course.
Yeah. By the time you do this, their seizure will be complete, and they will be threatening the use of nuclear weapons if there's a counter.
If they haven't actually used them to accomplish the initial assault. Mark Schneider, we have to pause. We'll be right back with more with one of the brightest minds in America today on nuclear deterrence, what it takes for us to have it, and how far short of that mark we are at the moment. Dr. Mark Schneider, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Mark Schneider is in the house virtually, I'm proud to say. A man, again, who I've found to be an extraordinary resource for decades when it comes to some of the most, well, important national security issues of our time. And Mark, you have made a very compelling case that one of the things that should be front and center in this election cycle, in the debates, in the interviews, in the point papers and policy positions and so on, of all of the candidates for the next commander-in-chief, must be nuclear deterrence. What are we doing to assure we have it in the face of the Russian threat alone? But I wanted, before we take stock on really where we are in all of this, I wanted to ask you about China. You mentioned it right out of the box. Communist China, we have been insistently told, as long as I can remember, for decades now, has only got something on the order of 200 to maybe 400 nuclear weapons, which would make it, an arsenal, I guess, roughly the size of Pakistan, a country that it put into the nuclear weapons business. And we seem to be under the illusion that that's because the Chinese really think they only need a minimal deterrent, the capability to inflict unacceptable harm on the United States to prevent us from attacking them. Give us a sanity check here, Mark, based on your deep knowledge of the facts, such as we have them, about what the Chinese have been doing over the past few decades. And as a result, what kind of nuclear power do they constitute today?
Well, I think we have institutionally grossly underestimated the size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal. It is, in my view, 2 to 3 times as large as is usually given credit for in the United States. In Russia, by the way, you frequently find some of their most important analysts and military, retired military, talking about even larger numbers than I do, numbers up to 3,000 plus for their current inventory. Now, the official U.S. government position is they're going to more than double what they have in the next 10 years, and I think that's undoubtedly true, but it's going to be from a base that's much higher than we simply give them credit for. Now, one of the most significant developments in 2019 was the military parade that they held in Beijing. During that parade, they literally drove through their capital city missiles, strategic nuclear missiles, and these are nuclear-only missiles, which had a delivery capability, if you use the standard numbers for those systems, roughly equal to what the entire Chinese nuclear capability is supposed to be under this, 200 to 400 estimate you see all the time. Now, that is really striking because there was no chance at all that they paraded their entire capability through Beijing. you know, in certain instances, we know they have many times that number, and you can go to the Pentagon report and do the comparisons, and you'll find that that's true. So we have a situation where we have systematically underestimated what their capabilities are. And if you go back to the earlier Chinese military parades, you can find the same thing, but not on this sort of gross scale. If you count the launchers that were paraded through Beijing, and you go to the Pentagon report on the number of ICBM launches they're supposed to have, mobile ICBM launches, you find that they paraded more than they were supposed to have, and this goes back a decade and a half. So there's a lot of evidence on this. There's also significant evidence, U.S. Military are beginning to recognize this, that no first use is nonsense. This is propaganda on their part, that they have a formulation that sounds good, sounds like no first use, but when you analyze the meaning of the words, it doesn't commit them to anything. And Colonel retired Larry Wurzel, one of the most well-known of the China military experts, and he's co-chairman of the U.S.-China Commission, pointed this out almost 20 years ago. There's no way that they can violate the no-first-use commitment.
Yeah. Let me just ask you, Mark, one of the things, and I personally find this a stupefying factoid. We've talked again about it before, but I don't think it can be discussed often enough. It tells you everything you need to know about China, about what it is up to, about its particularly ominous intentions with respect to nuclear weaponry, that it has built something called the Underground Great Wall. Tell us about that and what it, again, tells a serious practitioner of this business of nuclear deterrence about what they're up to.
Well, I mean, this is a underground tunnel facility. According to the Chinese, it's 400 meters underground, which means it can withstand multiple direct nuclear hits on any point in it. It is long enough to go from New York City to Los Angeles, and most of the way back to New York City again. You're talking about 3,000 miles. That is monumental. There's a tunnel in Europe between France and Italy. It's the Mont Blanc Tunnel. It's 16 miles long, and it cost billions of dollars to construct probably 20-plus years ago. So, 3,000 miles of much deeper underground tunnels with blast doors on them, presumably, and all the other equipment you will have in something like this. I mean, they even built the nuclear reactor, at least one that they have given publicity to as part of the system.
So, Mark, what do we think, besides a nuclear reactor, is in that tunnel network? Is it likely to be, in your estimation, the weaponry that would carry just 400 nuclear weapons?
No, that would be silly on their part. This is designed to hide and protect strategic nuclear ICBMs, nuclear capable or nuclear only type of weapon systems, mobile land-based mobile ICBMs. It would be absolutely insane for them to build a system that's this expensive for 50 or 100 missiles. It suggests many times that number is their objective.
They may even have the capacity, as I understand it, Mark Schneider, to manufacture missiles and presumably warheads and other things in those underground, protected, and unmonitorable locations. Which brings me to another point, Mark. The same is being done with respect to their submarine-launched deterrent capabilities, as I understand it. I think in caves under Hunan Island, you have submarine facilities and the like.
Sub tunnels. There are tunnels that go into the mountains. You can see them in commercial photography. they, I mean, this sort of thing goes back to World War II. They're big enough that they can hide their ballistic missile submarines in them and give them substantial protection while in port against many types of attack. And they're in the process of dramatically expanding their capability. The Pentagon report on China, annual report, has confirmed reports going back 10, 15 years about the new type 96 submarine with the new MIRV'd ballistic missile on it. They paraded 16 launchers for the DF-41 through Beijing. I mean that's almost 200 warheads alone.
So, Mark, when you look at this, and it's not just these weapons, I should say these delivery systems that both the Chinese and the Russians have been modernizing and putting into place, apparently with great national priority. It is also the case, is it not, as best we can tell, that there are new and highly modern designed weapons aboard those missiles, warheads that in some cases perhaps are capable of even hypersonic flight that we have to contend with now. And I just want you to address this quickly, Mark, because we've got to take another break shortly. Is it likely that the Russians and Chinese have been testing these nuclear weapons designs so that they can modernize them in this way?
Yes. In the case of the Russians, the Director of Defense Intelligence Agency has stated the Russians are probably testing based on what I found in Russian open sources. I think you can drop the word probably, that it's they're clearly testing them. China is in the same category. The U.S. Strategic Commission bipartisan 2009 reports that they may be testing nuclear weapons. There are other reports in the Asian media to the same effect. There's a report that the government of India takes these reports quite seriously. So I think both of them have been doing it. Now, in the case of the Chinese, they openly tested nuclear weapons through 1996, including the weapons that were deployed on these new systems that are becoming operational now.
And as we'll talk about more in a moment, that was 4 years after we stopped, something we have continued to maintain ever since. Mark Schneider, we will pause for just one last moment. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about what our deterrent actually looks like in the face of these sorts of threats and what it needs to be about, given their great and growing danger. That and much more with Dr. Mark Schneider of the National Institute for Public Policy, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the fourth and final installment of what I consider to be one of the most important conversations we ever have on this program, and that is about the most important national security capability in the entire arsenal, namely our nuclear deterrent forces. You'd never know that based on the way we have been thinking about them, the effort we've been making to ensure their viability, most especially that of the nuclear weapons themselves, the absolute critical component of deterrence. And Mark Schneider, we've talked now about Russia. We've talked about China. We're not going to have a chance to get into North Korea and Iran and Pakistan and other potential adversaries who are either in or getting into the business. But let's just talk about what it takes, as you see it, to assure that the United States of America effectively deters the kinds of forces that you've just described are a building or are in place now in the Russian Federation and in communist China. And how far short are we, as you see it, of that mark?
We've got a old and aging nuclear deterrent force, and we've got even older and more aging nuclear weapons. We haven't added a new delivery vehicle in the last 22 years. That's rather amazing. As I said earlier, the Russians modernized 76% of what they had, according to the director of STRATCOM, in that same time period. We are in a situation where the U.S. nuclear deterrent is literally going to decline for the next, almost the next 10 years, and then, best case, the modernization programs that are now underway are actually completed, completed in the sense of the initial deployments.
Let me just ask you, Mark, on this, just to make one point really clear here. We have an obsolescent nuclear deterrent right now, I hear you're saying. One that hasn't been modernized, especially the front ends of our nuclear missiles and so on, for decades. How far beyond the design life that those weapons were built on the basis of are we now, on average? Is there a way of saying, Mark?
Many decades in some cases. Look, the original B-52 bomber was, you know, assumed to fly for 10 or 15 years and then would be replaced by initially the B-70 and then the B-1. None of that ever happened. You have a U.S. bomber force which is still predominantly made up of aircraft that were built in the late 50s, early 1960s. The U.S. Minuteman III ICBM became operational in 1970. The last U.S. nuclear capable bomber to be added, the B-2 bomber, is about 25 years old, and none of them were built after 1997. And that's what we're in, and that's the situation. We're not bending any metal today. We're just about to start the construction of the first replacement Trident or Columbia class replacement for the Trident ballistic missile submarine.
But that will be years to come online, let alone in numbers. And Mark Schneider, when was the last time that the United States conducted an underground test of a nuclear weapon?
1992.
So 1992 was a long time ago, for heaven's sakes. And the other countries that we've been discussing have not observed a nuclear moratorium, at least not fully. What's the difference between having the ability to test nuclear weapons and not? I mean, for example, Mark, you mentioned that we have not introduced any new nuclear weapons designs. We were told rather insistently just a few weeks ago that the United States has now introduced a new nuclear weapon into the arsenal aboard our Trident submarines. Is that true, A? And B, if it were the case that we actually introduced a new nuclear weapon without having tested it, based on, you know, your extensive experience with this subject, would that be reliable as a deterrent?
Well, this is not a. I believe you're referring to the low yield Trident option, the W-76.
The so-called new nuclear weapon.
It's not a new nuclear weapon. It's just an adoption of the old W-76 design, so that you only get the yield of the primary. It's called a primary only design. That much has been officially announced. So you're not dealing with anything that's really new. You're dealing with something that's extremely important, that for the first time since the end of the Cold War, we've matched some Russian nuclear capabilities in order to deter them. I'm talking about a strategic low-yield weapon. See, Russian state media and other Russian sources reported, roughly starting in 2008, 2009, that the Russians had deployed or were about to deploy very low-yield strategic nuclear weapons on their SLBMs. That the reported yields were from several tens of tons to 200 tons of TNT. These are really low-yield things now. The reported yields in the U.S. media for the 76 Mach 2 are not even technically a low yield. They're over 5 kilotons. Some reports say 5 to 10. So we're not, we are they are relatively low yield, but they are not technically a low yield weapon that we have decided to deploy, and we have now actually deployed it. And as I said, this is extraordinarily important because it gives us a deterrent from Putin hitting us with a very low yield nuclear warhead and giving us a choice of doing nothing with regard to ballistic missile retaliation or hitting him with a very high yield weapon that could escalate the conflict dramatically.
So this is critical to deterrence, let's stipulate for the moment, but how critical is it for deterrence that there be confidence, not just on our part, Mark Schneider, but on the part of our adversaries, that these old weapons will actually work? And should we feel that confidence today, based on what you've said about how old these things are and untested?
The difference between testing and no testing, and we're in the no testing category, is with testing, you can be certain that they will work, or as close to certain as is possible. And without testing, it's opinion.
And that opinion, again, we're talking, you know, you began this conversation with me, Mark, talking about what's in the head of our adversaries. You want them to have as much confidence, don't you, of your capability to inflict unacceptable levels of pain on them. And if they don't think you're up to that, that can be the antithesis of deterrence, can it not?
Yes. They have vastly more confidence in their nuclear weapons working than we can possibly have about ours. And it's sort of the difference between physics and medicine. A good doctor can sometimes come to the right conclusion and treat you despite the fact that there's no certainty. But in physics, opinion and medical level certainty doesn't work.
You know, another analogy is one of my favorites that Mark Twain used to use. I called it the difference between lightning and lightning bugs. You know, and in this case, Mark Schneider, I'm not making light of this, needless to say, I'm deadly serious about how important is the message you're conveying and how appreciative I am that you have tirelessly been advocating for credibility of our nuclear deterrent to be enhanced, to be maintained regularly and modernized assiduously and backed up by testing and not compromised by fatuous delusions about arms control, especially arms control that's not being complied with by our adversaries. So for all these reasons, Mark, I hate to say this, we are out of time. I just want to end on that heartfelt thank you for your service to our country that you have rendered both in the State Department and the Defense Department, the highest levels of our government, and now at the National Institute for Public Policy, where you're doing splendid work on an ongoing basis. And I think they can find that work at nipp.org. Mark, thank you. Do come back to us again soon, sir. We appreciate you and really value our conversations. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.